Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association podcast. I am your host, Elisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician, and I'm super, super proud and super, super excited to be interviewing today Dr. Alyssa Hellman for the fourth time. If there are questions about our podcast, if you want to be interviewed, you know someone you want to hear being interviewed, anything, reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at JOMA.org. We want to hear from you. Dr. Hellman is also a proud JOMA member, like me, and has been super kind to be giving me so much time. And we are on part four, and it was so vast that, again, we are not done yet. And we're going to, Emir Sashem, do part five, we hope, someday. And we did not get to everything in this topic because it is just too broad, so please forgive us. Dr. Hellman is an experienced board-certified OBGYN. She has been in practice for over 10 years in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She received her medical degree from NYU and completed a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at North Shore Hospital in Manhasset. She is also the physician at the Confident Kala, a telemedicine gynecology practice focused on the needs of Jewish women who observe Taharat HaMishpacha. Throughout her years as a clinician, she noticed a gap in women's health awareness and education. This developed into a special interest in patient education and being a resource for the Jewish community in relation to body awareness and women's preventative health, starting from a young age. Welcome, Dr. Hellman. Thank you so much for joining me today for the fourth time.
Oh, thanks for having me back. It's more than a chazaka now, right?
Seriously. But we have to have our kala give birth. Have the baby. Okay.
Right. Yes.
So here we go. Let's catch up to where we were. We had not gotten to the end of her pregnancy. So we really need to go to the end. And there are some things that come up in that last trimester. So let's talk about first the glucose tolerance test. I don't believe we talked about that the last time.
Yeah. So that's, that's a test that we do on everyone. And it's a screening test. And look, there are definitely people who have more or less risk factors for developing gestational diabetes. And why do we even care about that, right? Like, we want to identify someone who may have gestational diabetes, catch it early so that we can mitigate the effects that uncontrolled gestational diabetes would have on the pregnancy, which can cause problems with the fetus and delivery itself. So that's why we do it. So a screening test means let's identify some, like, a group of people who we want to now look a little bit closer and see if they actually have it. So everybody does the glucose challenge test, which is a 50 gram glucose load. So you drink this super sugary, kind of like fountain soda type drink. It has a very specific amount of sugar in it. You fast for an hour. You don't need to fast before, but you fast for an hour after drinking it. And then you get your blood drawn and you want to see what the sugar level is. Like, what has your body done to get your glucose level normal in response to getting this big sugar load? And so every lab and office are kind of different as far as what number will trigger it being like a failed test. I'm sorry, I use that word fail. I don't like it. Abnormal test.
Exactly.
And so typically it's in the 135 to 145 range. So most people will use under 140 as a test that is fine, and we're not worried about gestational diabetes. If you have over a 140 or 140 and over, I should say, that triggers us to then do a diagnostic test. So whenever someone has a, what's called a positive screening test, we move on to a diagnostic test. The diagnostic test is a little harder to do. It is fasting. So usually people do it early in the morning, and it's four blood draws fasting. And then you drink a 100 gram glucose load, and then you get your blood drawn for 3 hours. So an hour later, 2 hours later, and 3 hours later. If you, so there's four values we're looking at. If two of those values are too high, you are diagnosed with gestational diabetes. If one of those values is too high, you don't have it because you need two. And so if you are then diagnosed with gestational diabetes, so that triggers a lot of more appointments and monitoring. You may be getting extra ultrasounds. You will be checking your blood sugars at home when you wake up in the morning and when you eat. So could be a whole podcast in and of itself, but this kind of triggers it. And that's so that we can make sure that there's no negative effects of a diabetes.
Right. I want to go back for just a minute to tell people not to panic if your first test is abnormal, because right. It is just a screening. I just want to underscore that.
Right.
And then go back to when it's positive and you've determined that the person has gestational diabetes, how is it treated? You mentioned it briefly, but I want you to go into it just a little bit more, because, you know, it doesn't mean automatically it's treated with a medication.
Right. So the most, you know, the first thing we talk to someone about when they are diagnosed with diabetes, gestational diabetes, is how can we make some diet changes and kind of decrease carb load, because those are sugars, to help get your numbers within a certain, your blood sugar numbers within a certain range. So after you eat, I would expect your blood sugar to be a certain value. And how do we keep it under that value? Or how do we keep it a fasting number under that value? When it could very easily be controlled by just what you eat and how much you eat and when you eat. So those are all things that take a couple weeks to kind of learn and figure out, and that's okay. If you are doing your best with your diet and the numbers still aren't great and they're too high, so that's when we start to add medication. And the medication these days now is kind of veered more towards starting insulin sooner because we see better outcomes. Insulin is given by injection, so slightly annoying, but it's just for 3 months, less than that really. And sometimes people will also add an oral hypoglycemic that is like a pill that you take to kind of help manage sugars. All of these medications are safe in pregnancy. I get that question a lot, but are they safe? Of course they're safe. We wouldn't be giving them to you otherwise, and they're helping control your sugars. That's the medication.
I just want to add one more thing as somebody who had gestational diabetes. Yeah. I found that the person that worked with me on my diet was not helpful at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know if things are different 20 years later. I think we know a lot more about the effects of fats and fiber and exercise on your glucose. And I found that out on my own, and I managed it without medication. So if
right.
that's important,
that's great.
I think you should see someone who really knows
yeah,
about this and doesn't just give you a list of how much grams, carbohydrates, everything has.
Yeah. And I will say, so yes, it is great to kind of have an initial consult with a nutritionist who knows things well about this
right.
when you are first diagnosed. But I do want to say, and this is what I experience in clinical practice, that if someone is doing an amazing job of controlling their diet and then the numbers still aren't good, especially the fasting numbers, which is really like, it's not your fault at all because
right.
you're sleeping, right? So if these numbers are getting very hard for you to manage, I don't want you to be starving. The goal is for you to not to be like not eating, right? I want you to eat. You're pregnant, you're growing a baby, right? If you're finding a very hard time controlling it just on diet alone, and you do end up needing medication for control, it is not your fault. It is your
right.
placenta. This is why. I mean, your placenta is causing the insulin resistance, which is what causes gestational diabetes. And some people's placentas just do that more than others. And it's not your fault. And it can get harder to control as the pregnancy progresses. But if you're doing a good job with your diet and you still need medication, it is not your fault for the diet stuff. So give yourself a little bit of grace there.
Absolutely.
And I should
so
say we just time frame wise really quickly, we usually check the screening test between weeks 24 and 28 of pregnancy. And if you have any other risk factors that may predispose you to gestational diabetes, sometimes we'll do an earlier one, like 16-ish, 20 weeks or so, to catch it earlier, just in case we think it's really going to come. Like if you've had gestational diabetes before, or if you have any other medical conditions that may predispose you to it. And then if that's fine, we may repeat it at the regular time. So you may have two of those screening tests at some point in your pregnancy too.
Right. And this is different from the type 1 or insulin dependent diabetes.
Oh, correct. If you already have non-gestational, like chronic diabetes, either type 1 or type 2 before becoming pregnant, that's a whole nother ballgame. You still have to do all the monitoring stuff, but that is, you don't need to do the gestational diabetes test because right. We already know you have diabetes. Yeah.
Right. I don't know if you want to take a minute before we move on to group B strep. We talk about this a lot, but it's important to talk about how there are different risk factors for having gestational diabetes, you know, without a pre-existing diagnosis, and to understand, I don't know if you want to go into this, to understand that after you have gestational diabetes, there is some increased risk for type 2 diabetes afterwards.
Yeah, about a 50% chance, lifetime risk, if you have gestational diabetes to develop regular like type 2 diabetes later on in life. So what I, you know, it's almost a little bit of a silver lining when you are sitting there in the last trimester of your pregnancy and you're sitting there like checking your numbers all the time and really being careful about your diet. It's great education and it's kind of almost good practice and learning of like, hey, how does my body respond to certain carb loads? And just being aware of it and on top of it so that like you carry that education, you know, after your pregnancy and throughout your life, be knowing that you're at risk for that. And then like, just be good about like, you know, a yearly or every couple of years screening for glucose and hemoglobin A1C to kind of, you know, just check and see like where your numbers are at and if it looks like you're getting close to that diabetes diagnosis.
Right. Just don't think it's over when you have the baby and ask for that big shake.
Right. Well, you can still, I always let my patients, I'm like, when they have gestational diabetes, I'm like, the baby's out. I'm like, have a muffin for breakfast. Go for it. Like,
right. Right.
It's but okay. That one time.
It is important to understand. Not everybody gets to know that. And I always want my information out there.
Right.
Okay. Can we move on to group B strep?
Yes. Let's do it.
Okay. Let's do it. We're going to move up in the pregnancy.
Yes.
When do we do that test?
Yes. So we typically do that test around 36 weeks of pregnancy. And why do we do that? So let's kind of back up of what is group B strep. So group B strep is so within our bodies, we have bacteria, good bacteria all over the place, right? Skin, intestines, vagina. And they're not infections, they're colonizations. And in the vagina, there are many bacteria. And one of those bacteria is a group B strep. So this is different from like the strep that you get when you have strep throat. That's group A strep. And so this specifically is called group B strep. And about 25 to 30% of women have this as a colonization in the vagina. It's not bad. It's not an infection. Very, very rarely would it maybe cause vaginal symptoms, but it often doesn't. You probably don't even know you have it. But why do we care? Because if you have it in your vagina and the baby passes through it during delivery, that can cause an infection of group B strep in the baby. And that infection in the baby can cause horrible like outcomes of like meningitis in a newborn, pneumonia in a newborn, two things you do not want your baby to have. Sepsis can really cause lifelong problems and even death in your baby if they were to get it. So we want to identify which women have this so that we can help prevent an infection in a baby of a pregnant woman who has this colonization. The risk of exposure starts to the baby once your water breaks. So if we identify you later in the pregnancy, we don't start treating it, because if we just gave you some oral antibiotics, it could come right back because your body's kind of colonized with it and it doesn't eradicate it completely. So we treat you at the time when it matters most, meaning when you're in labor, when your water breaks, because that can be a long time and that those bacteria can kind of climb up and you know, expose the baby to the risk of infection. So we check it at 36 weeks because we have seen through many studies that the result of the culture that we're doing lasts for about 5 weeks. So these colonizations can kind of come and go. And we see that when we find group B strep, we know that it for sure is going to be there for about 5 weeks. What's 5 weeks from 36 weeks? 41 weeks. Most people have had their baby by 41 weeks. So that's why we don't like to do it too early, because what if you go a little bit late past your due date? So we do it 36 weeks is kind of that sweet spot where we do that culture. It is a vaginal culture and it should also be a rectal culture, vaginal rectal culture as well. So if you feel like you had this little swab put in your vagina and then you feel something by your rectum, that's because it is also placed there as well. The results come back in a couple of days and then we know, and then your doctor, if you did test positive, your doctor should talk about what antibiotics are given and when. You know, sometimes we'll get a little pushback of like, hey, I don't want this done. Why do I need this done? Or I don't want antibiotics when I'm in labor. It's really, really to help your baby. Definitely.
Wow. Why would somebody say no to antibiotics if they're colonized? What are the risks of not giving the antibiotics?
The risk of not giving antibiotics is fetal meningitis, or I should say neonatal meningitis, sepsis, pneumonia, and death. I've seen it. It's bad. It's not great. Yeah.
Wow. Because what are the risks of antibiotics?
I suppose someone could have a little allergic reaction, but, we obviously identify that if someone, so typically we'll treat with penicillin. The dose is given every 4 hours in labor. The goal is to get at least 2 doses in. That's considered adequately treated. If you have your baby super quickly, like before that second dose comes, so then the pediatrician who's checking out your baby will probably want to keep the baby there for a full like 48 hours just to monitor for any signs of infection. So often we don't do like an early discharge if you want to go home early and you had group B strep and you didn't get treated adequately. But if you're allergic to penicillin, which many people are, there are other antibiotics. We can use clindamycin, vancomycin, depending on like what your allergy symptoms are.
Right. What about a C-section? Do we still worry about that?
You mean testing for group B strep if you're going to have a C-section or?
Well, no. You would test regardless. You don't decide whether or not to test based on whether you have a planned C-section, right?
Well, you actually don't really have to test if you are planning on a C-section because you're not really planning on a vaginal delivery. Some people will still test you just in case you break your water before your scheduled C-section date and there is that risk of exposure. The issue is that if you are identified as group B strep positive and you're planning on a C-section anyways, once you break your water, you are going to get your antibiotics, your pre-op C-section antibiotics anyways, which is usually NSF, which also covers the group B strep. So you're getting the appropriate antibiotics. And if you are just in labor or you're coming in for a scheduled section and you haven't broken your water yet, the barrier between the baby, which is the amniotic sac, and your vagina is not broken because the baby is coming out. It's bypassing that with a C-section. Right. So your baby's not exposed to the vaginal bacteria. So that's kind of the thought behind that. Some people will check group B strep, even if you're planning on a scheduled section, and some won't.
Right. And in the case of a section that's not planned, you may have had a long period of time with rupture of membranes.
Right. So this is not even a group B strep issue, but if you've had group B strep, you definitely have been treated throughout your labor for it. If you are in labor and you go to C-section, we actually give 2 antibiotics. One is ANSEF to help protect you from surgical wound infection from the skin. The other is azithromycin that we give to kind of help also decrease risk of infection, both to you and the baby. Before doing the surgery, we give those 2 antibiotics.
Okay, good. Yeah. I think we covered that. Okay. I don't think we talked about vaccines and serology testing the last episode.
Yeah.
If we did, guys, forgive us.
I don't think we did. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll run that through them really quick. Usually, one of the main vaccines first in the beginning of pregnancy, we are actually on your prenatal blood work. We are testing, part of that is testing to see if you are immune to all of the vaccinations and the infectious agents that we assume you were immune to from your childhood vaccination. So those are things like rubella, hepatitis B, and we monitor that. Those are 2 vaccinations that we actually don't give while you're pregnant. So it's something that we want to know about. So that those would be push off. If you find to be non-immune to that, we would give that to you after you deliver, the MMR vaccine to cover rubella and the hepatitis B vaccine.
Right. Why do we do that?
Well, rubella can actually cause, if you are infected with rubella during a pregnancy and you're not immune to it, it can cause some pretty bad birth defects. And so we want to make sure that, look, we can't immunize you if you're pregnant already, but we want to make sure for a subsequent pregnancy that you wouldn't get infected with rubella and you have a good immunity to it to fight it off for a future pregnancy.
Right. I think it's also important to know that a pregnant woman will transfer passively her immunity, her antibodies to the baby, but only if she has those antibodies.
Correct. And there's still there's still, it's not enough immunity. That's why we vaccinate little babies. You know, and then hepatitis B, of course, you know, you can get, definitely be exposed to that through, you know, needles and medical situations, you know, so we definitely want to make sure that you're immune to that as well.
So also, just to make it very, very clear, this is passive transferred antibodies that do not last. And the timing of the baby's vaccine schedule is to take into account that the baby will have passive transfer, but then it will wear off.
Correct.
And so the timing is to continue the protection. It's not lifelong transmission of antibodies.
Right. Exactly. So those are the two we think about beforehand. Then standardly, but in the third trimester, we will give the Tdap vaccine, which helps cover pertussis. Pertussis causes whooping cough. And whooping cough, if you know, a baby gets that infection within the first couple months of life, which can severely affect the lungs and cause a bad pneumonia, you don't want your newborn having pneumonia. Their lungs can't fight it as well as an older person. And so we immunize the mom for pertussis with that vaccination. Adults need that vaccine every 10 years. And so I have some pregnant women are like, wait, I just got it with my last pregnancy. I don't need it. And no, you are getting it for this baby to transfer that passive immunity. So if you are pregnant 5 times in 10 years, you're getting the Tdap 5 times because you're getting it for your baby. You're not getting it for yourself.
Right. I just want to point out, I'm giving the pediatrician angle here.
Yeah, go for it.
That to understand that, first of all, pertussis is more than just getting pneumonia. These babies turn blue and stop breathing. Right. And unfortunately, we've had some very sadly deaths in our community in babies from this disease. It's important to understand that the vaccine we're using now is an acellular vaccine, whether it's the DTaP for kids or the Tdap for older kids and adults. It is less, causes less reactions, but the immunity is less long acting. And so that's the point, that you may get an MMR 2 times and you have potentially immunity for life. You do not have immunity for pertussis for life. It is not as long lasting, and that's why we give it with the pregnancy.
Exactly. Yeah, because most people are pregnant once their immunity has kind of worn off already.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll briefly bring up 2 other vaccines. One is if you are pregnant and going to deliver within flu season, we highly recommend the influenza vaccine. And those are people who are going to have their baby, I'd say, you know, anywhere between like October through April. And if you're pregnant between October through April, which is most people, you know, having a baby or being pregnant in that time frame. The reason for that is twofold. One, as a pregnant person, your immune system is suppressed. And so you have a harder time fighting off infections. And if you get influenza, and we're talking about like actual influenza, not like, oh, I'm sick, my stomach hurts for 2 days, it's the flu. No, this is real influenza. If you are pregnant, you can likely get a lot sicker. And I've seen people in the ICU with influenza in pregnancy. It can get bad really fast and then have negative outcomes on the pregnancy itself. The other reason is not just maternal, but also that passive immunity. So we don't vaccinate babies until they're, correct me if I'm wrong, 6 months old for influenza.
Correct.
And so you're having your baby like in January, the only way this baby can get some type of protection until the next flu season, which is a different shot, the only way is to get vaccinated when you're pregnant and give some of that passive immunity. So that's why we highly recommend the flu vaccination in any trimester of pregnancy, like whenever that would be. We usually start giving it in around October, November time. Just so that the immunity lasts through that end of the flu season. And then I'll just briefly mention COVID. COVID vaccinations are cringy. I'm just going to say one sentence about it, that COVID vaccination is safe in pregnancy. We recommend it. I'll just leave it at that. I don't feel like I have good like guidelines yet for what is going to be available over the next few years and what the recommendations are. But I can tell you that in the past 3 years, we definitely recommend COVID vaccination in pregnancy.
It's very sad, but unfortunately, the horrific communication about COVID and the COVID vaccine has made it harder with all vaccines. I don't know if you're seeing more pushback for any of the other vaccines as well, but I find COVID the hardest because it's a newer vaccine. pregnant people especially are so, like, they just don't want to do anything that could hurt their baby and they get scared. But almost everybody's had COVID at this point. And so I think that does, you know, change the conversation. We're not pushing anything here.
Nope,
we're
not just at all. Throwing we're just it saying out there. What the recommendations are.
Yeah, yep. We're just throwing it out there and we can't go any further
right.
with that. I think it's just, it's a hard situation. And I think that building the trust and having collaborative, you know, conversations is so important.
Right, for sure.
Not to just dictate, this is what I say you should do.
Right, definitely.
But honest. Okay, we're going to move on to contractions that are early and are not necessarily indicative of labor versus how do you know when you're in labor?
Right. So let's define labor first, right? Labor means regular contractions and cervical change. So you can have regular contractions that are not causing cervical change. And by change, I mean dilation, effacement, things like that. And that you need a cervical exam to assess. So if you are having really like kind of painful regular contractions and they're lasting every 5 minutes and you get checked in the office or in the hospital and you're 3 centimeters, and then a couple hours later, you're 5 centimeters, you are in labor. It is changing. These contractions are doing something to your cervix. If you're like, oh, you know what? I'm starting to like feel kind of uncomfortable and let me start looking at my watch and kind of starting to time it. And you notice that over a few hours, they're getting more uncomfortable. Let me just get checked out. So you get checked, you're 1 centimeter, and then you're still kind of uncomfortable. You may want to be checked again a few hours later. And if you're still 1 centimeter, you're not in labor. This may be the beginning of early labor. Only time will tell. We can't always say, I know for sure what's going on. We need time to kind of tell. But a lot of times you have what's called Braxton Hicks contractions or non-labor contractions. It's called preterm contractions. And those are contractions that are there. They're kind of annoying. They make you wonder, but they're not causing cervical change. So you're not in labor. Many times they will just fizzle out on their own. So they may be regular for a couple hours and then go away. The Braxton Hicks contractions, often to kind of distinguish between labor contractions, are usually not as painful. They're tight and they're hard. Your belly may pop out a little bit. It may feel like a rock. It may happen when you're moving. So like, especially position changes, like when you're sitting down or getting up or running upstairs or getting in and out of a car, and where your belly just feels tight, but it doesn't like hurt like a bad period cramp or like a labor contraction. And so those generally are not concerning. We kind of expect them. They're a little bit more frequent and start earlier in subsequent pregnancy. So as your pregnancy count goes up, you may notice them more. And especially as you have like other little kids at home during a pregnancy and you're doing a lot more bending, you may notice those. But they're typically like pretty normal and not considered labor contractions. If you find yourself not being able to breathe through the contraction, or you have to like stop walking and hold on to like a railing or a wall, okay, this may be like something to kind of stop and monitor and see, is what is it becoming over the course of a few hours? So that's kind of, I guess, subjectively how we kind of differentiate different types of contractions.
When do you start doing internal exams to see if the person is dilating? Because you can also dilate painlessly, correct?
You can. We typically, like with that 36-week groupie strep check, your underwear is already off. We already have a swab in your vagina. So it's kind of a good opportunity to kind of get a baseline of like, hey, where is your cervix starting out from? And also check position of the baby. Do I feel a head when I do that cervical exam? So those are, that's kind of an opportunity to do that. You know, some women who are on their third, fourth kid, they may already be 2 centimeters dilated by then. And how did that happen? Time, downward pressure of the fetal head on the cervix. And also those little Braxton Hicks and kind of random little contractions that you're having do cause that cervical change. And then often we will do cervical exams in the office in that with your prenatal visits in that last month. We don't have to. It's definitely not a requirement. I think it is nice to have one baseline one, so we kind of know if you come in wondering if you're in labor, at least we have like a baseline to compare to. But is it an absolute necessity? It's not. We'll figure out if you're in labor or not. So.
Right. I want to go back a little bit, not too much, because it's really its own topic, which is preterm labor, because we kind of skipped signs of preterm labor.
Right. So signs of preterm labor would, of course, be signs of non-preterm labor. So regular painful contractions causing cervical change. Often when your cervix changes and dilate, that tissue itself kind of breaks down a little bit and stretches. And so you will see bleeding. That's what that bloody show is, you know, which we'll maybe talk about later. So if you see any bleeding in your preterm, if you have a lot of vaginal pressure all of a sudden with these other symptoms, that could be signs of labor. Very rarely there's something called cervical insufficiency, where the cervix does painlessly dilate. Often if someone does have this condition, it could even start to be picked up at the 20-week ultrasound, when they always do a cervical length check and they check out the cervix, make sure that it's normal. And if it's short or if it's dilated already at that point, that usually kind of clinches the diagnosis of cervical insufficiency. And that's a whole nother podcast in another.
I know, we can't do everything.
But that is, you should know that at the 20-week ultrasound, which is standard for anatomy, they are also measuring the cervix to make sure that the, you know, to kind of catch any early cervical insufficiency issues. But look, if something doesn't feel right and you just feel like, you know, lots of pressure and pain and bleeding, like, gotta call your doctor and go in and get checked out. That's like the only way to know. It's physical exam is super important when it comes to assessing labor.
Right. What about rupture of membranes before labor starts?
Yeah. So the normal course of labor, and there's been lots of studies done on what is the normal course of labor. Many things happen outside the normal course of labor and everything ends up just fine. But the normal course of labor is you start at labor with painful contraction, cervical change, and somewhere in the middle there, your water breaks. It's called rupture of membranes, spontaneous rupture of membranes. And some people though will break their water first and then go into labor. And most of the time, if you've broken your water first, which is called premature rupture of membranes, before labor starts, then usually within 24 hours, it will set off labor. Now, if you have that strep bacteria that we talked about, you're going to want to go in, even if you're not in labor, you're going to want to go in to start your antibiotic treatment because the exposure to the baby has started. And signs of your water breaking would be either a big, huge gush, and it's not mucousy. It's literally like you turned on a faucet from the sink, water coming out. So it may have like a sweet smell. It may have a little like chunky stuff in it. It may have like little pinkish tinge or blood in it. That's all generally okay. A lot of blood, not okay. Go to the hospital. But the norm would just be like a big gush or a constant trickle. So, you know, when you pee, you can kind of like hold in a little bit and you kind of know that you're where you're peeing from. Amniotic fluid, you can't hold in. It's just going to keep coming out of your vagina. And it's like kind of every time you push down a little bit, it's just going to spurt out and trickle out. If you're not sure, sometimes you'll like put on a pad and you'll be like, hey, my pad is constantly wet, like it's never dry. And that maybe also be a way to know that you broke your water. Sometimes it's just pee. And sometimes it's just like a watery vaginal discharge. And so that's when you have to go to the hospital and get checked out. And we have tests to determine if you did break your water. Preterm premature rupture of membranes, right? You're not in labor, you're preterm. That needs to be checked out. That is a hospital admission. That's a big, you know, we treat you and manage potential labor and delivery at that point. But that's something that this could happen early on. And so you want to get checked out if you are worried that happened.
Right. And this is just beyond the scope of the talk to talk about prevention and treatment of it. We just can't. And again, we're not your doctor.
Right.
Call your doctor with any questions. Okay. So what about breech position? What if you find breech positioning in the third trimester? I'm just be very broad here.
So again, that 36-week visit is an important visit and that exam is important. So we do that strep test where I'm doing a cervical exam where we can assess your dilation if there is any and position of the baby. And yes, you can also assess fetal position by specific maneuvers and kind of hands on the belly too. But this is also another way to check it. And we can actually like feel the fetal skull. It feels like a hard skull. And that's what we can feel inside when we do a cervical exam. So most of the time we're like, yep, there's a head down there. No worries. But sometimes we're like, I don't really feel anything down there. Or like, it feels super soft and kind of butt-like as opposed to head-like. Cause you don't have any hard bones in your butt. if we are, based on physical exam, if we're really kind of not sure that there is a head down there, we just throw an ultrasound onto the lower part of the abdomen and we can tell where the head is. So if a breach is then diagnosed, or, and how is the, what type of breach? Are they feet down there? Is there a butt down there? Is it transverse, meaning laying across, and there's like just a back down there? So that's something that we would then kind of talk about the management of it. Most babies will still turn if diagnosed at 36 weeks of breach. And then, so then we keep checking weekly, like at 37 weeks, repeat the ultrasound. Okay, head down, great. Like, let's go on our merry way. It's still breach. So that's when we would probably start active management. So we talk about external cephalic version, which means you come into the hospital. You may or may not have an epidural. That's kind of doctor and hospital specific. And using a lot of gel on your belly and kind of watching with ultrasound, you, your doctor with or without an assistant will try to move your baby by pushing it around through your belly, your abdomen, to try to move it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And there are some risks involved in it, where, you know, fetal heart rate changes or some bleeding. And so that's something that we would talk to you about it beforehand to see if you want to accept those risks. The other option, if you don't want that, is to schedule a C-section. So in, well, let me back up. So there are some other ways that I will admit I am not fully versed on to try to help move babies. There's like a spinning babies technique. Some people will use acupuncture. Some people will put like music between their legs to encourage fetal movement. And, you know, I'm cool with people trying all those things. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And sometimes the baby would have moved even if you didn't do those things. Right. And sometimes you do all those things and the baby still doesn't move. So go for it. Try what you want to do. But if baby ends up being head down or feet down, or butt down or feet down, then the way we deliver most often in America is by a scheduled C-section. The reason for that is you know, looking at the anatomy of a baby, the head is the largest part diameter wise. And if the head comes out first, we know most of the time that everything else will come out easily. If the body comes out first and then the head is still left, and it could be a hard delivery, even getting the body out. There could be difficulty getting the bigger part of the baby out, which is the head. And a lot of stretching and stress and pressure on the neck of the baby could happen. There are very important nerves in the neck that go to arm and hand function. And we see a lot more obstetric injury with breech deliveries affecting these babies who have like you know, motor deficits in their hand movements. So because we see so much more of that, we recommend C-section delivery for breech babies. So can you deliver a breech baby vaginally? You can. You also just need a trained, you know, delivering provider to do that who has experienced that before. I'll tell you personally, I've done 4. My whole career. So am I the expert in breech vaginal delivery? No. Could I do it when it was required? Yes. But it's not something that we kind of like standardly offer. So then we would schedule a C-section. If you had a planned scheduled C-section for breech, when you come in to get admitted, the first thing you have done is an ultrasound. What if your baby flipped, right? If the baby flipped, the C-section is canceled, and we can either do an induction then, or you can go home and wait until you're in labor. Sometimes we'll kind of encourage an induction because, hey, what if this baby flips back again? Because it seems like it's a flipper, right? So we may just say, hey, baby's head down now. Let's see if we can get a vaginal delivery, right? But yes, we definitely always confirm before we would make any incisions that there's still the indication for the C-section.
Absolutely. And you mentioned inductions. I want to talk for a few minutes about reasons for induction. And I feel like the state of the art now is not to go beyond and sometimes even fully to the due date in some cases. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay. So induction is a super, super big topic. So I'll try to either talk fast or try to be succinct.
No, well, you know what? This is kind of like a primer. This cannot be everything. We'll never finish.
Right. So, okay. So why would we even induce? That's, I think, the first question. The reason we would induce is because a few reasons. One, there's a medical condition, both maternal or fetal, where the baby or the mom or both would be safer with not being not pregnant. Okay, like babies should be out in the NICU to get care. Mom is developing a medical condition or has a medical condition where the further the pregnancy goes, the more dangerous it is for her or her life. And so we want to end the pregnancy, picking a time that is beneficial both for the mom and the baby for best outcomes. That's the reason for induction. You can also be induced because you want to be done with your pregnancy. And there are rules of what the time frame for that would be. You can also, well, I guess those are the kind of the two main categories. So when we look at induction, and the time frame is very important. So let's look at the end point of it. So we know that our due date is 40 weeks from your last period to your official due date, that's 40 weeks. We look at outcomes week by week by week on babies who are born at, 32, 37, 39, 40, 42 weeks. And what does that look like? So we kind of see that from 39 to 40 weeks, babies do the best. And then as you get further along after your due date, up to 42 weeks, babies still do okay. The complications do start to slowly go up in that 41 to 42, that 42nd week. And after 42 weeks, we see a lot more complications, including a much increased risk of stillbirth. So ACOG has come out to say, all pregnancies should end by 42 weeks. In personal practice, doctors may kind of have their own time frame. So I personally like to get babies out in that 41 to 42 because I definitely see more complications as we get closer to 42. And it's always a conversation, right? Always. If someone wants to be like, I'm so done with my pregnancy. I want to be done. I'm 36 weeks. Can you induce me now? No. You want to know why I can't induce you at 36 weeks just because you're uncomfortable? Because I'm putting your baby at risk for more complications of prematurity. So we found that 39 week completed weeks is babies are fully cooked. We see very low complication rate, both for mom and baby. And so if someone wants to be induced or has risk factors that would make it safer for inducing, that's a great week to kind of start out with. I'll leave it there and see if you have any questions.
Right. So how do we monitor the baby in that last trimester? Because I think monitoring the baby will come up with reasons to maybe do an earlier induction that we didn't get to.
Right. So if someone is having a very low risk pregnancy and under age 35, typically we will not do any extra monitoring. We just do like the regular Doppler heart rate checks on your weekly visits at that point until you've reached your due date. After your due date, we do what's called either non-stress tests, biophysical profiles, or both. Non-stress tests is where instead of just listening for, 10 seconds on the Doppler, we hook you up to a monitor on your belly and we are watching the little squiggly line that the baby's heart rate pattern makes. And we can tell based on the pattern of that line, if baby's looking good and looks super happy, or if there are little subtle signs on there where, I don't know, maybe baby's starting to get stressed out. Maybe that placenta is starting to expire a little bit and maybe delivery would be safer. We usually do that every 2 to 3 days once you've passed your due date. Of course, with talking about an induction scheduling, or hey, you probably will go into labor, right? Chance of labor once you reach 39 weeks is quite high. So we can't forget that the only way to have a baby is by inducing, right? Like, labor could happen. If you have a medical condition that would require other monitoring like those. And I should also say the biophysical profile is an ultrasound as well. An ultrasound looking for very specific things that get scores and points. And we're looking at fetal movement, both bigger movements and fine motor movements. We're looking at the fluid level. We're looking at the practice breathing motions that the baby is making, right? They don't breathe air, but they can practice moving their diaphragm and their rib muscles to practice their breathing motions. And those are all very, if all of those are there, we're very reassured. And so we put all that together and decide like, hey, everything's probably going to be fine in the next few days because everything looks really good now. There's no absolute reason for induction. If there are any medical conditions, or age-related conditions that does carry the risk of complications higher than a low-risk pregnancy. So we start that monitoring a little bit earlier. It could start at 30 weeks. It could start at 34 weeks. And that's all really determined by what you're being monitored for. But that's kind of how we assess a little deeper the well-being of the baby.
I'm also going to just add one thing that you may have what looks like a low risk pregnancy, and then you go in and you just do measurements, even just abdominal measurements or a sonogram, and get measurements. And you may say, oh, this baby I think is too big, or the amniotic fluid is low, or the baby's too small. And that can bump you into a higher risk category. That's number one, I think. Yeah. And number two is I think that different, you know, practitioners have different styles. You may have a more interventionist approach and you may have a less interventionist approach. And I think that you, as the pregnant patient, should be comfortable with the style of your practitioner. It should mesh with yours. I don't think know if you agree with that or not.
Oh, completely. I've had patients who've like moved or transferred and they're like, wait, my doctor did an ultrasound at every single visit. I don't, right? And that's just not something my office or system can handle. And just as far as scheduling appointments. And that doesn't mean that one was wrong and one was right. There are ACOG does have some guidelines for doctors of what is appropriate at each prenatal visit, which we follow, every doctor may have a different practice style. Some things are maybe standard in one office and not in another. So if you move around like throughout your pregnancies, like you may kind of experience different kind of perspectives on that monitoring.
Right. And I want to go for just a second into that there's not just doctors taking care of pregnant women. There's also other practitioners. That's why I use the word practitioner. And again, you're giving the OB and a specific, perspective of an OB, right? Mm-hmm. Your style of an OB. But we also have midwives and other professionals doing this. I don't know if you want to go into that at all. And also the role of a doula. I'm really squeezing a lot in here.
Oh my God, what are you doing to me?
Okay.
So yes, midwives, I think are wonderful. I think that I think as a patient, right? Cause like that's who we're talking to right now. Are you the patients, right? I think it's important to know what type of provider is appropriate for your pregnancy and your care. So, midwives are trained for, low risk pregnancy, low risk labor, right? So, if you are overall healthy, you don't have any like complicating factors, during your pregnancy or just even without pregnancy, a midwife is perfectly appropriate. The questions to ask for, if you are going to use a midwife, is what is your protocol and like procedure for if there's an emergency? What if I become high risk in the middle of my pregnancy due to a diagnosis that comes up in the middle? And like, who would my care be transferred to? Do you work in a hospital? Like what is available for me if I go from being a low risk patient to a high risk patient? What kind of like coverage of doctors do you have? If like an emergency happens in labor, how fast can they get there? Things like that. Those are important questions for you to know so that you are fully informed. And then to know that if any high risk stuff happens in the middle, like if you have like hypertension or diabetes, and those are just kind of like standard complications, are you going to be transferred to the OB that they are affiliated with, which you should be. So look, there may be regional differences, that I can't speak to every single office, but that's important for midwifery care. You also want to make sure that they are certified nurse midwives and not a lay midwife. Lay midwives just don't have the same type of certification or experience that a certified nurse midwife has. So I'm going to put a plug in for that. What were your other questions, Dula? Did I finish the midwife thing?
You finished. Yeah. You did a fantastic job, but we need to go into where you are going to have the baby. You mentioned Ask the midwife. I want to put a plug here for a team approach, mm-hmm. that you don't have to be all or nothing. And a doula can be a really great addition to your team. And mm-hmm. I'm going to link it to the talk with a doula. But I want to talk a little bit about births in a birthing center, home birth versus in a hospital with whoever is delivering the baby.
Yeah.
I think it really matters.
Right. So there are many places you can have your baby. You can have your baby at home. You can have your baby in the car if you don't make it, right? You can have your baby in a hospital. You can have your baby in a birth center that does not have like the same, it's meant just for birth, but it does not have the same type of rooms and technology as a hospital.
Right. So I mentioned that a birth center can be either in a hospital or adjacent to a hospital or completely separate.
Right. So that's one of the things you want to find out if you are planning to deliver in any place other than a hospital. So how fast, if I have a massive hemorrhage or if, you know, something looks wrong with the baby, how fast can I get to a hospital that can take care of my needs? So not just a hospital, the labor and delivery unit and obstetricians, you know, available. You know, I'll start. Well, let's talk about a hospital. So a hospital, what does that have to offer? It has monitoring, and the fetal monitoring can be, it's available. So it can be done either continuously throughout labor or intermittently based on your risk and overall risk of, you know, what medications you're on or what your medical conditions are, or what we're monitoring baby for. If a hospital also has operating rooms that can be there to have C-sections quickly. It has anesthesiologists. And that's another thing to find out. Is your anesthesiologist, is there someone there all the time, or is there someone that they would have to be called in from home if you needed an epidural or a C-section? It has the ability to do what's called operative delivery. So things like a vacuum or forceps, if your doctor is trained or midwife is trained in either of those. So it has the technology to deal with any situation. Now, because it has all that technology and because it has a lab associated with it, medications and pharmacy and all that, so sometimes we'll see more intervention in labor and delivery in a hospital. Not necessarily a bad thing, but some people don't like intervention. So that may be the person who's like, you know what, I want to minimize my risk of any intervention. I'm going to go to a birth center where, yeah, I'm not at home, but I'm with people who are used to taking care of laboring women. And just have my baby in that place that just seems a little more in line with where I'm at with my medical care. It's important to understand what the risks are and the benefits, right? So if the benefit for you is less intervention, great, you will definitely get less intervention. What are the risks? So if you have something, because you can be low risk until you're not, and that can happen in a second. And I think that's the most important thing that I think we can say when we're talking about where to deliver is understanding what could happen and what's available to deal with those situations. So if you have a massive postpartum hemorrhage after your baby comes out and you're losing half of your blood volume, so how quickly can we help you? If it's 20 minutes from now, that time frame, that's really scary for me as an obstetrician because it could have a really bad outcome with that. So how fast is the hospital? How fast is it from calling 911, getting you in the ambulance, getting you to the hospital, and getting you in your hospital room where you have people who can take care of you? So it's not, oh, the hospital on GPS is 5 minutes away, or, you know, I can get there super quickly, I live really close. No, count from minutes from diagnosis to minutes to treatment, and that can sometimes be much longer than your GPS as the crow flies, right? So that's why they have these birth centers that are like a hallway down from a hospital. So it gives you that environment where you feel very low intervention and you feel like it's less medicalized, which some people really enjoy, but if something were to happen, you are very, very close to a place that can handle any emergency.
Right. I also want to add from the pediatrician's perspective and the baby's perspective, they say the best incubator is the mother, right? And it also matters whether the hospital has what level NICU, you know, neonatal intensive care unit they have. Because again, you cannot anticipate all emergencies for the mother and or the baby.
For sure. And you know, not every hospital does have a NICU. So right. Another question to ask is, what if my baby was super sick when it came out? What if there was an emergency and my baby needed medical care right away? What are the protocols for that? Like, how fast does transfer to a NICU happen? You know, and it's important if there's any very identifiable risk factors ahead of time, you know, before delivery, to say for your doctor or your midwife to say, I don't want you delivering at this low risk hospital. I'm worried about baby, you know, if there's like some sort of type of birth defect or something, a baby would need care immediately or you're preterm. You can't deliver in a very low risk place because your baby needs that care. So we're transferring you to a place that has a higher level of care because we are anticipating, we know what you're going to need. It's the unknown that kind of makes obstetricians, I think, a little bit nervous about delivering in a place that doesn't have the care, the quick care that may be needed. So that brings me kind of to home births. And this is, I know, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say. This is, you invited me on here, so I'm just going to say it. But
go for it.
Yeah, ACOG does not condone home births due to the increased risk of neonatal mortality, which means death. And, you know, if one baby died because they were born at home and, you know, that could have been prevented, I personally see no reason to have a home birth when we have many other delivery places that can be a hybrid between your home and still being able to get the medical care that is needed. So because of that increased risk, which to me seems way too high, so I am not a fan of home births. In the home birth community, there is a lot of talk of being the right patient to proceed with a home birth. And that means a low risk pregnancy, not having a previous C-section, not being a breech, not, having other medical conditions that could cause birth, you know, difficulties or complications or risks. And that's, I understand that. And I think that's a good perspective to have. But again, you can be the most low risk patient there is and turn high risk in a second. And I have seen that multiple times in my 17 years of delivering babies. And that is what scares me, is the knowledge of you can be super low risk on paper, and then all of a sudden you're not, and you're at a place where you can't get help.
Well, I'm just going to tell one story really quickly without any identifying factors, and it's from many years ago. I had a family in my practice who, I think the mother was considering a home birth, and the baby was born with a cardiac anomaly that if they had not been in a place with a level, you know, high level NICU, the baby would not have made it. And it was not detectable before birth. Not everything is.
Right.
And she had no risk factors, none.
Right.
So you can't always predict these things. Again, we're not telling anybody what to do here. We're just giving the information as we see it from this perspective.
And I'll tell you, something like that is rare, right? So that's almost going to be like an outlier of like reasons. But there's things like, I'd say the two biggest reasons would be like a postpartum hemorrhage, shoulder dystocia, to think about having your baby's heads being out of view and not the rest of the baby cannot come out. And it takes many, many minutes to get to a hospital. Your baby could die. To me, that risk is that means everything, right? So that's where I am. I'm obviously a medically trained obstetrician gynecologist. That is my perspective. I've did my residency at a very, you know, high level NICU where I see all the stuff that can happen to moms and to babies. And to know that can be prevented, if someone is in a place that can get, you know, quicker care, I don't understand the home birth thing. Again, many people with home births have a beautiful birth, right? And so I'm not discounting that in any way. I'm talking about it from a risk perspective. My job is to make sure that I can treat and manage any major complications, right? When it's a nice regular delivery in a hospital with me, I'm literally the catcher, right? I'm as hands off as I can be because it's the mom doing the work. I'm just catching, right? And that if every delivery was like that for the rest of my life, that would be amazing, right? It's when things don't go like that. And that's what hospital care is for. I'm not knocking anyone who has a home birth. I'm just saying that risk for me is too much for me to accept for my patients. So that I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, but it's a perfect segue to birth plans. I don't want to go into that for too much. And I actually talked a lot about it with the doula, who herself is very non-interventionist and gave birth at home with a late term baby, which my comment was, don't do this at home.
I'll agree. Okay.
So again, my perspective, the baby was fine. Thank God.
Okay. Birth plan. So, do you need a birth plan to have a baby? Absolutely not. If you want one, have one, but I think you need to understand and just based on our conversation so far is that you can plan whatever you want. I can plan whatever you want. I can plan whatever I want, right? Plans don't always go as you want them to. And I think that's kind of like, I when I talk to my patients about birth plan, I say, I would love to know what your preferences are. And that's why I like to actually use the word preference instead of plan. You can tell me what you prefer. You can tell me, how do you want your birth to look? And we will do our best to make that happen. But know that if something happens out of all of our control, right? That's not my control or the nurse's control or even your control as the delivering mom. We are reacting to situations that could change very quickly. And then the plan needs to change. There's a plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, right? Like I could go down the whole list of what we do when certain things happen. That's not going to be on your plan. But you have to have room for some flexibility if things change. That's what being a parent is about also. And I kind of like to frame it that way of like, you are at the beginning of your parenthood right now, right? Your baby's not out yet, but you are pregnant and you are starting this life of being a parent, and you can want everything to go perfectly and just the way you imagined it, but I will guarantee you it will not throughout parenthood. So think of that. This is your first step of opening your mind to knowing that as much as we all want it to be the way you want it, and I hope it can be, there is room for other, right? And to just accept that. But can I go over, like, if you want to write things down, can we go over it? Of course. If there's something that like is not in line between you and me, like as the patient and the physician, you know, let's talk about it. I'm going to give you my reasons why I have a different perspective. And then you're going to give me your reasons why this is something that you really want. And you know what, at the end, we may actually come to agree with each other and be in line with each other, because we were misunderstanding each other. You didn't know where I was coming from. I didn't know where you were coming from. Great. Wonderful. And so it's the reason why a birth preference guide is really, it's helpful, is so that your doctor understands you and, you know, you understand your doctor. So that's what I'll say about that. I think it's helpful to bring, if you want to bring anything written, to bring that and talk about it with your doctor, one of your last prenatal visits. Always stuff that you have questions about in labor can be a running conversation throughout your pregnancy, prenatal visits. But don't leave it. If there's something super specific, like if you're like trying to hide from your doctor that you don't want an IV, don't talk about that when you get to the hospital, like bring it up. You know, it's always very disconcerting to be like, well, I didn't think there was an issue that we had to talk about, but you know, there is, and let's talk about it when you're not in pain, right? Or when you're, you know, in a more calm office situation. So that's what I'll say about birth plan preference.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. Let's have the baby.
Yes. Yes. Having the baby. Well, where are we going with this? Because there's a lot of
we're in active labor. We are in the hospital. What kind of things can you expect with a hospital birth? Because yes, it can be quite more interventionist. And I'm going to just put a plug again for making sure that you are comfortable with your OB, that you have that relationship. Trust means communication.
For sure.
Right. But there may be things that you cannot control, not only with how, you know, your labor progresses or whether risks show up, but also say you're delivering at a certain hospital. The hospital requires an IV, and then you get to the hospital and your plan was not to have it, but they require it.
Right. So I think I hesitate to use the word require. I think that if there's ever something that you feel forced into, it's always a conversation, right? And no one in the hospital is going to strap you down and force you to do something. Okay. You always have the right to refuse. You just have to know why it's being recommended to you and what the risks are for refusing. Right. So, you know, that's kind of what I'll say about that. You know, but that's why it's a good idea to kind of talk about it ahead of time with whoever's going to deliver you, so that you're kind of all aware of each other's, you know, perspectives. you know, there's a lot of things that happen in a hospital, at least when you come in labor, you know, and there's reasons for all of them. Like I want kind of people to understand my perspective of there's nothing I'm doing to you just because, or there's nothing that we monitor just for fun. Cause like, hey, we can bill you. Like, that's not how we think. Everything we're doing has a reason behind it. And you can always ask, hey, why are you doing this? Do you need to do this? Or can we do this later? Or, you know, asking those questions, if you start to feel uncomfortable with something, you should always know why things are happening to you. If you want to, you may not care. You may just be like, get this baby out of me, right? But you definitely can always ask questions of whoever is taking care of you to find out what's going on and why.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So what things should you expect in a typical hospital birth? You get to the hospital, you're determined to be in active labor. You are starting to dilate. You're having regular contractions. You're admitted. Then what?
Right. So then, you know, once they kind of determine that you are in labor, meaning regular contractions and cervical change. It really, I guess, kind of depends on what the plan was, if there's any medical issues, and what the treatments or monitoring for that would be. But let's assume that everything is super low risk. So we literally wait till you keep going on in labor. I mean, there's, you know, you're in a place that things can happen if needed and things can be given if needed. But, you know, most of the time things just happen on their own and we just kind of wait it out. You're being monitored. We're watching what your baby's heartbeat is like during labor. We're watching what your contraction pattern is like during labor. We're doing physical exams every couple of hours to kind of assess, is there cervical change? What's your bleeding like? Did you break your water? So all those things are kind of going on. If you want pain medication, that's also something you could get in the hospital. So that's, you know, IV narcotics, that's an epidural, you know, there's other pain relief modalities as well. Like some people like to go in the shower or be in the tub with warm water. They find that soothing. So those things are available in most hospitals. So, you know, that's kind of up to you. There's, you're usually in a bed. You definitely, if you don't have an epidural yet, you definitely can be getting up and moving around and walking around, based on what cervical exams and kind of assessing baby's position. We may kind of position you in different ways to kind of encourage baby like coming down to the birth canal, and or turning in a certain way that is a little easier for delivery. So you may like every hour or so be changing positions, and the nurses do an amazing job of that. And you know, if things start to stall, we talk about augmentation, which means giving like a medication like Pitocin to kind of help continue labor in its natural pattern. I mean, that's kind of what the labor looks like, at least in a hospital.
Right. It's a backtrack a little for someone who's getting induced. It looks a little differently.
Yeah. Right. So for someone who's having a planned induction, that is something where you're going to come in at the scheduled time, you get your IV and you get the medications in that will bring on contraction. So depending on where your cervix is starting out from, what the exam is, so you may get one of a few medications, either Pitocin through an IV, something called Cervidil or Cytotec, which are prostaglandins that are inserted into the vagina, which kind of help soften and slowly dilate the cervix, you know, that first few centimeters, and then usually switch over to Pitocin. Your water may be broken by your provider, which is almost like a tiny little crochet hook. That's kind of what it looks like. And we do an exam, we can feel the membrane and we literally just pop it. It doesn't hurt at all. You know, the cervical exam may not be super comfortable, but the actual rupturing of that membrane is not uncomfortable. Once your water breaks, that often encourages baby to descend further down into the vagina. And it also helps continue the process of labor. And so those are things that may happen with an induction.
Right. I want to go back to both the Pitocin and the epidural because, you know, that's like the famous cascade of intervention.
Yeah.
Concern. So I just want to give you a few minutes to talk about that, meaning that, you know, when you come in for an induction, you know, if you do get Pitocin or you get Pitocin because your labor is stalling, what can that do? I'm kind of pointing you in the direction of the contractions may be more fierce. You may have thought you could do it without medication, but maybe not then. Maybe.
Right. So when we start talking about intervention with labor, and it's because we are looking at your labor pattern and we are seeing something abnormal, right? There is a normal curve of labor. And, you know, we know that in the beginning, the earlier part of labor can take a lot more time. It also depends on what number baby it is for you. But it can take a lot more time. And then as you get to a certain point, it usually speeds up a little bit. So we can kind of, and we kind of have an idea of like how many centimeters is normal to dilate over a certain amount of time. So we have these standard patterns that we're watching. And if you start falling outside of the pattern, does that mean we have to do anything right away? No, it doesn't. It means sometimes we are thinking about, well, maybe we'll have to do something. It could be we don't need to, because all we had to do was just wait a little bit. If we kind of determine, well, you're really falling off the curve here, and things really, like time is going on, or I start to see, you know, fetal distress or something that's more, maybe starting to be more of like a negative outcome, then I think we should start to speed up the process. And that could either be augmentation, meaning you're already in labor and we want to, speed, like kind of continue it, or induce, meaning like start from scratch. That is really kind of taking your body of where you're, what you're already doing, and just helping it along. And so the giving Pitocin, which is kind of the main thing we use for induction, just helps maintain that regular contraction pattern. If you've kind of stalled out on your own for whatever reason, it does help continue that process of labor.
Right. But you didn't mention that it can increase the contraction intensity.
Well, look, the contractions,
and that may take you from being fine because it wasn't so painful before to, oh, I didn't know it was going to hurt this much.
Contractions hurt, and regular contractions hurt, and Pitocin contractions hurt, and it's the contractions that get babies out. And I think that's something that's like, okay, you can have your own contractions every 10 minutes, your labor is going to be 10 times longer, right? Or you can have contractions every 2 minutes that either are on your own or with Pitocin, and that's going to get the baby out much sooner. So do they hurt? They hurt if you have your own or Pitocin ones. Pitocin is, you know, oxytocin, which is what you make anyways in your brain. And it does the same thing. We're just like giving a little more to kind of help it along. And we can kind of up increase it and decrease it. That's kind of, I guess that's my perspective on Pitocin. It's not something we just use on everyone, but it's definitely something that can help. And some people are like, get this baby out of me, like speed this up. What can we do? Or if you have an epidural and you're already comfortable and your labor has stalled, great. You're not going to feel any worse because of Pitocin, for at least to kind of bring on contractions. So that's what I'll say about that. Yeah.
Right. Let's talk a few minutes about the epidural, though, because you mentioned you might already have an epidural.
From a doctor perspective, I do not care what you decide, right? Like, that's your decision. And I always tell, especially my new moms, that let yourself make the decision in the moment. Don't come in saying, I'm not getting an epidural. If you come in saying, I know I want an epidural, that's kind of the other side of it. But if you let yourself experience the pain and see what you're able to handle with it. And if you are like me, three contractions into labor and you're like, this isn't going to work, get your epidural, fine. But if you're like, you know what, I can handle this, I'm doing it. Then great. Then you can wait, or you cannot get it at all. Right. And so, I just don't want my patients and anyone having a baby to feel the guilt of like, oh, I had to get the epidural. There is nothing wrong with asking for pain relief when you are in pain. You have a headache and you take some Tylenol, no one's going to give you guilt for that, right? So there should be zero guilt. Also, just don't ever say, I didn't have a natural birth. If you have an epidural, there is nothing unnatural about wanting pain relief. So that's definitely what I'll say about that. Is it a medical procedure? Are there some risks and complications that are a possibility? Of course, it is a medical intervention, right?
I was going to say, there's two kinds of epidurals, right? There's one where you can't move and one where you can, or am I wrong about that?
So there's something called the walking epidural. I'm going to be honest, I don't really know much about it because I've never been in a hospital that offers that. But there was something called the walking epidural where I guess you had pain relief and could still walk. I'm kind of confused as to how that works. I'm not an anesthesiologist, but yeah.
Right. The reason I'm saying that is because I think it's, we have to be, you know, transparent that the likelihood if you get an epidural is you will be bedbound.
Right.
At that point.
Right.
So that we need to be transparent. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, definitely. So what it does is it's an injection into the epidural space of the spinal column, and that numbing medicine bathes the nerves that go both sensory and motor to like kind of, you know, upper, a little above the belly button and down. So you feel numb, you feel tingly, like your feet really feel weird. You do not have the motor strength to stand. You may be able to actually move really well in bed, like turning from side to side and moving your legs around. But as far as being able to support yourself standing up, usually you cannot do. So yes, you are in bed. That doesn't mean you can't change positions in bed. That is still a possibility. And it has a little catheter inside that spinal column that allows more medicine to be infused in, because we don't know how long your labor is going to last. It's not like a one-time injection. And so that kind of allows it to provide pain relief throughout labor. Now, it also provides pain relief if you have a laceration and it needs to be sewn up. Usually you don't need like numbing medicine. If you don't have an epidural and you have a laceration, we just inject some numbing medicine in before we put stitches in. But that epidural does allow for pain relief, not just for labor, but for the things that happen after labor as well. Yeah.
Right. So how long do we let labor go now? And I'm sure that'll vary among different practitioners.
Yeah. So again, using the word let it go, I'm going to, you know me in wording, right? I don't think it's for us to let or not let. I think it's a very individual situation. If you want to labor for 3 days and I'm monitoring your baby and your baby's looking good and I don't see any signs of fetal distress, go for it. 3 days is a little long. I mean, most labors, like full labors, are usually done within 24 hours, and most of them shorter than that. It depends when we're starting labor, especially with like inductions and, you know, early labor and lately, you know, more active labor and, you know, we can get into definitions there, but, you know, as long as I see, cervical dilation progression or fetal descent progression, like even if it's slow, but the progress is there. So then we keep going with what we're doing and until we, you know, have a delivery. If things are not progressing, so that's when we talk about intervention. And some people, you know, some doctors definitely have more patience than others. And I think that's also a personality and a discussion with your doctor of like, okay, what kind of doctor, what kind of, you know, labor management, you know, perspectives do you have? You know, like if I don't have any cervical change in 2 hours, are you going to give me a C-section versus, hey, like, would you wait 6 hours to see? And some may be like, yeah, sure, whatever. Like, as long as baby's doing fine, I have no problem with that. So I think there is, you know, it's very practitioner dependent.
Throw in the how long the membranes have been ruptured is a factor too, correct?
It can be, definitely. We do see increased risk of infection after about 18 hours of the uterus, membranes being ruptured. So that doesn't mean that, oh, we have to do a C-section if your baby is not out within 18 hours after rupture. It just means that now we're going to start trying to decrease mm-hmm. the risk of infection by giving antibiotics in labor and making sure that I'm not seeing any signs of infection in the uterus already in both you or the baby. So if that's the case, then we're like, hey, we need to speed this up somehow. And that could mean a C-section, but most often it doesn't. Most often it just means like, now I need to start intervening to decrease your risk because you've reached a point where now you have a risk of something else happening, right?
Right. So when you say intervening, you mean either Pitocin to speed it up if they haven't had it, or if they've had Pitocin and it hasn't speeded it up, a C-section.
Yeah. I mean, if labor is not progressing.
Right. No, in that situation, when it has not progressed. And as a pediatrician, I see babies born all the time by C-section due to what they call failure. I hate that word failure to progress. And again, it's
a discussion. I like to say arrest of descent or arrest of dilation. Yes.
You are never a failure. You're just not a failure. And that's not a thing.
For
okay.
Sure.
So I know you're short on time and we're going to get that baby out. any issues with the pushing stage? How long? I'm not going to say let it go, but how long would be typical and how long might be outside the range of typical?
Right. So that really depends on first baby, second baby, first baby or subsequent babies, and then with an epidural, without an epidural. So with an epidural, sometimes it takes a little longer. And with the first baby, sometimes it takes a little longer. And you are going to, I'd say average time for a first baby is around 2 to 3 hours of pushing. Many women do shorter than that. And usually with not a first baby, it's usually less than an hour. But these are all very generalized timeframes. And I hate giving people timeframes because then they feel super stressed that they're falling outside of it, right? I want to see progress. That is what I care about. So if I see the baby coming down and moving, that's what I care about. If it takes you an hour to do that, if it takes you 4 hours to do that, I need to see progress. And that could mean pushing in different positions. That could mean, trying to kind of talk about body mechanics and how do we get the most effective push. That could mean turning an epidural down a little bit if it's too high, if it's, you feel too numb. So we can try to help you push more effectively if things seem like they're taking too long, but all I care about is the progress. It's not going to be oh, it's been 3 hours and you haven't had your baby yet. It's not out yet. That means C-section. No, it depends on what is happening. You could be pushing for 2 hours and the baby has not moved. You know what? 2 more hours probably isn't going to do much either. It's just going to stress you out and the baby out and cause a lot of pelvic floor dysfunction. So we really kind of, don't ask me about that. That's another podcast. But, that's something that, again, is in the moment, right? There's the norm of what typically happens, but then there's also am I seeing progress? And if I am, great, let's keep going.
Do you use forceps ever?
So I was not trained in forceps. I do not. I would use a vacuum in that type of situation. No, I don't use that.
But you could use a vacuum. In other words, this doesn't just mean a C-section. There's other alternatives.
Right. And that's called operative delivery with forceps or a vacuum, and that there are very specific criteria of when we would do it. And we talk about that's a whole nother subject, but yes, that's something that would be a discussion and has very specific reasoning for it.
Right. One more thing, and we're going to wish our Kala a mazel tov. She's had her baby, which is episiotomy.
Yes. So that has definitely... do this to me all the time. That definitely, an episiotomy is when the delivering provider, midwife, doctor, actually takes a scissors and cuts the vaginal opening to make more room for the baby to come out. I would say that I was in residency 17 years ago, and I definitely saw some older providers do them routinely. Newer providers were absolutely not. So I think this is really a trend that has changed in obstetrics over the last generation. I would say in general, most providers now do not do them routinely. My philosophy is if you're going to tear, you're going to tear what you need to tear. When would I do an episiotomy? If there was fetal distress and this baby needed to come out on the next push, and the only way for that to happen because the skin of the opening was too tight. That's the only way. And I probably do 2 a year. It's so rare that I would do it.
Right.
It's something where even if you did have one, the stitches to sew you up are the exact same as the stitches to sew you up if you tear on your own. And a lot of times it's a lot less irregular of a laceration because it was made by a scissors instead of by you tearing. And that's something that is, it may even actually be easier to sew you up with an episiotomy. It's definitely, I think, not a standard routine part of delivery anymore and would only be used in emergent situations.
Right. I'm going to let you go because I know that we went way over and I appreciate it so, so much. And I'm going to have to cover the fourth trimester. We didn't even get to the placenta, but mazel tov.
It's a baby. Baby's out. She's on your chest. Have no clue what the doctor's doing down there because you're so happy with your baby and that's all you care about. And she's screaming away and all is good. You're sitting there on your phone, taking pictures and calling everyone. So
yes,
mazel tov. And I am happy to continue later on.
Oh, thank you so much. We have part 5.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.